On this week's 51%, we meet a transgender woman who fought the health system.
I understand the shock. I can't say that the reactions that I got were unexpected. I mean, it's what I had feared all my life.
Follow two young female scientists in evolution territory and hear from a storyteller about building on the body positivity movement. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Ricky Bates fought to have her insurance pay for her gender affirmation surgery, and in 2014, she won. But becoming the woman she always wanted to be put her at odds with her greatest passion, music. From Orleans on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Rachel Ishikawa brings us the story.
The drums kind of just stirred up something inside of me that was exciting.
Ricky Bates loves drums and has known that since childhood.
In the 60s, early mid-60s, when the Beatles played on Ed Sullivan.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
One of the things that I took away from that, like right off the bat, was seeing Ringo play and thinking, wow, he's having a lot of fun. I want to have fun too. And I just became determined to play drums at that point.
After a few semesters studying jazz composition at Berklee College, Ricky moved to Cape Cod to play music full time. Cape Cod may seem like an odd choice for a rock and roll musician, but there's a tight-knit music community here. Ricky found a network of musicians pretty quickly and started playing regularly around the Cape. But that hasn't been the case lately, and it's not by choice. Aside from the occasional gig here and there, Ricky's mostly playing music alone, just for the love of it.
We're at Craigville Beach, and we're at the gazebo. I feel like I have a spiritual link with this particular spot. Here we are. Music shuts my thinking mind off, pretty much. I mean, when you play music, there's a fair amount of improvisation, usually with my favorite bands. You know, conscious thought gets in the way of that. So you have to kind of cast that off and just go into feeling mode. I don't fit the stereotype. I'm pretty sensitive about a lot of things. I'm not a star. I mean, I didn't get into playing music because I wanted to be the person out front who gets all the attention. I got into music because I loved music.
In the 70s and 80s, Ricky was well known for drumming on the Cape. But there was a part of Ricky that no one knew about.
I knew when I was maybe four or five years old, when I started getting bullied and stuff, I knew I had this thing that was different about me. The kids were picking on me for being girlish. What does it mean to be girlish? It hurt. I'm not a rock and roll dude. I'm a woman. I'm transgender. What do you call a drummer without a girlfriend?
What?
Homeless. How do you tell if the stage is level?
How?
You know, if the drool comes out of both sides of the drummer's mouth. I've been out since 1990. I had a real big breakdown. I got into therapy with a new therapist who had worked a lot with transgender people. She was like almost immediately, you know, listen, you got to come out. You can't hold this in anymore. Do it, do it, do it. So I did. Within like a week's time, she had me just dressing full-time as a woman.
Through the 90s and into the 2000s, Ricky went on and off hormones. She says the hormones enlarged her breasts, softened her skin, and redistributed fat around her hips. But the hormones plateaued after a certain point, and she stopped seeing change.
I really forever felt that I needed to have the surgery, have complete, you know, gender reassignment surgery, or gender affirmation surgery, as it's called, but I had no way of paying for it.
In 2013, Ricky finally made the leap. She put in a request to her insurance, MassHealth, to pay for her surgery. MassHealth rejected her request, so she appealed. While she was waiting for the outcome of the hearing, former Governor Deval Patrick amended state policy. Both private insurance and public programs would now cover trans health needs.
We felt like our case had a huge influence on Governor Patrick's decision to change the regulations in the state. For us, that was a huge win.
Ricky finally had her surgery in May of 2017.
I would say my condition now is more defined by what I'm not thinking about all the time. It's a release from this heavy burden that I felt I carried around with me for all my life. It's just gone. You know, in day-to-day life, when something rotten happens, it's like I can kind of sail through it.
But Ricky's transformation came at a cost.
People were shocked. And I can understand the shock, you know. I understand the shock. I can't say that the reactions that I got were unexpected. I mean, it's what I had feared all my life.
And her music suffered, which meant that her income did too. A band fired her after she came out in 1990, and she was asked to dress as a man for some other gigs, which she begrudgingly did. She started working with the band that fired her again, but overall, her work has been sparse.
Some of these people just outright just stopped hiring me on gigs, and you never know for sure if it's because I'm transgender or if it's something else. I ask myself, you know, what's wrong with me? What have I done wrong? I mean, am I not a good musician? All my fans and my friends say, no, you're a great musician. It can't be that. So, okay, then what is it? There's still a part of me that doesn't want to accept that it's discrimination from people. It kind of tears you up. I do think that it is very important for trans people to have forgiveness if they can. It's certainly more dignified to have forgiveness. Being scornful does not work.
Did you feel like you had to make a choice? You know, like you got surgeries, like you came out, all these things. Like now, like it's hard to get work and it's hard to be a musician.
Yeah, it's frustrating. Yes, yes. You know, but I have to say that like since the surgery, I still have hope.
In Orleans, Massachusetts, I'm Rachel Ishikawa.
Charles Darwin, who was born in 1809, was best known for his theory of evolution. Yes, there was controversy over his belief that female inferiority was a result of natural selection. Well, we're not going down that path at the moment. Rather, we'll focus on the overall evolution aspect and mark International Darwin Day, which was February 12th, on the date of Darwin's birth, by heading back a few years deep into Darwin territory and following a few budding female scientists who themselves were following in Darwin's footsteps. Darwin's theory of evolution was based on observations of birds and other wildlife in places like the Galapagos Islands. Evolution is not always quick, and the gender mix in science is no exception. Men still dominate many scientific fields, just like they did in Darwin's day, but gradually more women are selecting scientific paths. We meet up with two young women scientists in, where else, the Galapagos. Veronique Le Capra is our guide.
I'm Veronique, and this is Mari.
Mi nombre es Maricruz Jaramillo, y soy de Quito, Ecuador.
Maricruz Jaramillo grew up in Ecuador's capital, Quito, but she always loved being out in nature.
When I look at pictures of myself when I was little, I always see, like, I have a really happy face when I'm outside. I don't know, maybe I associated it with spending time with my family and my dad. Then I could just run, and I would pick up stuff from the ground, and I just really love being outdoors.
I was pretty much the same way. I brought my mom home tadpoles, caterpillars, earthworms, and eventually a PhD in ecology and evolution. Mari's getting hers now from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And she's doing fieldwork in the one place I think every ecologist wants to go.
Ever since I knew I wanted to be a biologist, I wanted to come to the Galapagos Islands. That was my goal. And my dream, too.
But they're not easy to get to. The Galapagos Islands are in the Pacific, 600 miles west of Ecuador. From St. Louis, it took me 2 days, 3 flights, a ferry ride, and 45 minutes in a pickup truck to get there. Charles Darwin took a ship, the HMS Beagle. He was only 26 when he visited the Galapagos, about Mari's age. What he saw changed his life and the history of science. Most of the wildlife that lives on these volcanic mounds is found nowhere else in the world. Giant tortoises, marine iguanas, and those little sparrow-like birds known as Darwin's finches. Mari first made it to the Galapagos 5 years ago. She's back again, studying a kind of malaria that's infecting birds here. In Hawaii, avian malaria has driven many native bird species to extinction. That hasn't happened in the Galapagos, but Mari and other scientists are trying to gauge the threat.
It's 5:30 in the morning, and it's just barely starting to get light in the sky. I'm meeting the researchers who are going to be setting up some mist nets to catch birds.
Who wants to set another net?
Mist nets look sort of like volleyball nets, but around twice as high and reaching almost to the ground. Their mesh is nearly invisible. The birds fly right into it and get snagged. Mari and the others work quickly to untangle them.
When you have a bird in your hand, it's just really warm and soft, and you can feel its really fast heartbeat. And you just know that you're holding something really fragile.
Each bird gets weighed and measured.
This one's 45 grams.
Mari, or one of her helpers, takes a small blood sample to test later for malaria. Then they release the bird again.
This little one is ready to go.
Samoa Asigao speaks Motu, along with Pidgin and English, among the many languages in her country, Papua New Guinea. It's an island nation just north of Australia. Samoa met Mari in graduate school in St. Louis. She's in the Galapagos, trying to help solve a different piece of the avian malaria puzzle. Which species of mosquito is transmitting the parasite from bird to bird? Just before dusk, Samoa sets out her traps.
The thing about trapping mosquitoes is you have to think like a mosquito.
Female mosquitoes, they're the ones that bite and can spread disease, like to lay their eggs in stagnant water. So Samoa mixes up a smelly brew for her traps.
Every time I pour this water, in my mind I'm like thinking like, mosquitoes, please come, come to it. So I can trap more mosquitoes in the morning. Seriously, that's what I do every time. Oh, it smells good, right?
Actually, it smells like rancid gym socks. The smellier the water, the more mosquitoes she'll get and be able to dissect. Working with a microscope, delicate tools, and very steady hands, she'll chop off their tiny heads and extract their salivary glands to look for the malaria parasite. Samoa has stared at so many mosquitoes so close up, she has started to appreciate them, especially a species called Aedes aegypti.
It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's covered in these black and white bands all over its legs, all over its abdomen, its face, and yeah, the first time I saw it under a microscope, I kind of fell in love with it in a weird way.
Samoa says her parents encouraged her to get an education and pursue a career in science. But she says most people in Papua New Guinea hold strongly to traditional beliefs and gender roles.
And just growing up and looking around and seeing the opportunities that were given to males rather than females, that sort of placed an aggression in me, good aggression, that told me that, hey, why do males always have to get chosen over females?
For Samoa, becoming a scientist started out as a way to prove herself. But eventually, it became more than that.
I realized that, no, science was something that I really wanted to do.
Once she gets her PhD, Samoa wants to return to Papua New Guinea to help protect wildlife there. And she hopes to be a role model and train a new generation of female scientists.
empower young girls, empower women, and tell them, you know, if I can come from a country like Papua New Guinea, come and do research in a place like Galapagos and study at an institution like my university, then you can do it too.
Her friend Mari plans to keep doing research in her home country of Ecuador, maybe in the Galapagos Islands.
I don't know exactly if I would enjoy my life as much if I wasn't a scientist.
Sometimes, though, Mari thinks about all the hard work and long hours.
But then I realized, like, what else would I be doing? I wouldn't be enjoying it as much if I was doing something else. So it's my way of life. It's essentially what I am, I think.
I'm Veronique LaCapra.
This story was produced for the PRX STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. There will be no more grid girls before Formula One races and no more podium girls celebrating with the drivers after them. F1 Managing Director of Commercial Operations Sean Brachus says the use of the women on the grid is clearly at odds with modern-day societal norms. At F1 races, women dressed in uniform walk out onto the grid shortly before the race and then stand in front of each driver's car, holding up the driver's number. Women also stand alongside the winner on the podium after the race. The Formula One season starts on March 25th at the Australian Grand Prix. And here's a brief profile for Black History Month.
She is regarded as the first female self-made millionaire in America, Madam C.J. Walker. This is Heroes in Black History. Born Sarah Breedlove on December 23, 1867, in Delta, Louisiana, she, like many women of the era, experienced hair loss due to harsh chemicals used in soap products or bad hygiene and diet. At the age of 20, Sarah began to learn about hair care from her brothers while working in their St. Louis barbershop. 7 years later, she became a commission agent selling products for Annie Turnbow Malone, an African-American hair care entrepreneur. During this time, Sarah adapted her knowledge of hair care and hair care products. Soon after, Sarah moved to Denver to develop her own hair care business and married Charles Joseph Walker, a newspaper advertising salesman. From this union, Sarah began to be known to the public as Madam C.J. Walker, an independent hairdresser and retailer of cosmetic creams. To grow her business, Madam C.J. Walker trained women as beauty culturists and to learn the art of selling. Using the organizational model of the National Association of Colored Women, Madam Walker began to organize her sales agents into local and state clubs. In 1910, Walker moved her headquarters to Indianapolis, where she built a factory, hair salon, beauty school, and a laboratory to help with research. She also started her own mail order business to keep up with the booming business, placing her daughter, Alelia, from her first marriage, in charge of it. In 1917, she convened her first annual conference of the Walker Hair Culturist Union of America Convention, the first national meeting of American women to discuss business and commerce. Her business market now expanded outside the United States to Cuba, Jamaica, Haiti, Panama, and Costa Rica. Madam Walker was an advocate of civil rights and financial supporter of historically black colleges. Madam C.J. Walker, the first female self-made millionaire in America, a true hero of black history.
And writer Dr. Jerry Burns builds upon the body positivity movement.
I applaud our times. Contemporary sensibility and social media have cracked open a vault that I've been hammering away at all my life. See, I've always been more curvy than slender, and therefore never really saw myself represented positively in visual contexts. From fairy tales with characters who look like illustrated versions of Zoe Saldana, to television sitcoms with more Saldana types, to movies, advertising, and everything else with, Zoe Saldana types, I didn't see my body type reflected on screens or pages for most of my life, save for Ethel Mertz. But with today's newfound favor on body positivity, all kinds of body types are represented more and more frequently, not just in esoteric publications, but in mainstream advertising and media. Body positivity is positively a movement, and because of it, Victoria Leone feels comfortable talking to the media about her situation. You see, a volunteer Toronto musical group, the Sheraton Cadwell Orchestras, sent a letter to their singing performers saying that singers who were not fit and slim could only wear loose dresses that did not emphasize their, quote, dietary indulgences, end quote. The physical size of instrumentalists was of no concern to the management because musicians are seated in the background. In short, the organization fat-shamed its own volunteer singers. Eventually, this came to the attention of the media, and the orchestra has since closed its doors upon itself. Ms. Leone, one of the targeted singers, is a young woman who is comfortable with herself and the skin she's in. So she has willingly taken on the orchestra and the media by discussing the shocking behavior of the management regarding her appearance. Ms. Leone is positive about her body, and this cheers me greatly. The body positivity movement focuses on building positive self-image regarding weight and fitness. But there's another aspect of body positivity that we don't hear quite as much about. How many older women have body positivity? How many cover up their bodies or try to mask the march of time? Not only are older women consigned to the darker corners of magazines and advertisements if they appear at all, they are pushed into corners of the social fabric of society too, as if getting older isn't already fraught. I have a friend. Her name is Gail Russ. She is a wonderful Cherokee storyteller, and though her stories are wise, some of her greatest wisdom comes right out of her. She said something to me many years ago, something that I've never forgotten. I've held her thoughts at heart as I fought against the increasing press of years in social opinion and society's blatant dismissal of older women. I've tried to take her wisdom on as my mantle. Truth be told, I'm not doing so well, but I am trying. Gail said that one of the most beautiful things in the world are the lines on an elder's face. To her, they are decorative symbols of living. They are bottomless pits of knowledge and experience that can only come with the passage of time. To Gail, an elder's face is the pinnacle of beauty, something that at the time she was looking forward to, something positive in her future. For many more of us, that time of life is something to dread. With every passing birthday, people say, tongue-in-cheek, better to get older than the alternative. Most people settle for aging with that sentiment at heart. But how many of us truly embrace it? Gail Ross does. Of all stages in life, positive thinking is sorely needed when people age. So, while society readjusts its cookie-cutter standard of youthful body image to a place where people are proud of their unique and individual body types, mightn't there also be something to be gained from aging positivity? I don't know if this is an official term, but I think it should be one. If we can readjust our lens and love the size of our bodies, we can also love the size of our cumulative birthdays. So let's look at some ways that time leaves beautiful footprints on us. Every wrinkle is composed with the depth of life lived thus far. Older bodies are reshaped by the amazing strength that carries people through the byways of life's many challenges. Older people are imprinted with a mosaic of the spirits of loved ones and the best of humanity encountered in all phases of life. Older people are tenderized, not broken. Older people and their bodies remember times and places that happened in real space. Older skin is tattooed with experience and wisdom. People can love themselves and the skin they're in, like Victoria Leone, Gail Ross, and, I suspect, Zoe Saldana, with rolls, wrinkles, or anything else that each unique body offers. So why not tilt society's head just a little bit so that everyone can see the beauty of the entire human being, including those people marked by energetic youthful vision and those marked by seasoned, tenderized wisdom? Let's make aging positivity a thing.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1491.